and welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. My name is Luke Burridge, and this is the show where I review every single science fiction book that I read. As I read it, there's no set schedule. It's just whenever I finish a book, I do the review and stick it up here on the podcast feed for everyone to download and listen to and hopefully enjoy. And joining me today, like normal, is Juliana.
Hello, everyone.
And you read this book as well.
I read this book as well.
Is this the first time you've read this book?
It actually is.
Yes. So this is maybe, I don't know, the fifth or sixth time I've read this book. This is a longtime favorite book of mine for, I would say, most of the way through the book. And I've always had issues with the ending. But let's get to that as we go through. This is Have Spacesuit Will Travel by Heinlein.
Yes. And I want to pop in here and say something because you just asked me a very important question.
What?
If I have read this before.
Yeah.
Now, I would say, I mean, it is agreed upon that this is young adult or like, you know, for young people.
Yeah, this is a children's book.
And when I was young, of course, I didn't read books in English.
Right.
So I read books in German.
Yeah.
And now here's the terrible, terrible thing about this book.
What?
The German translation of the title.
Is what?
Is Die Invasion der Wurmgesichter.
Right. The invasions of the worm faces.
Yes.
So it's set up as though it's going to be an alien invasion book.
Yes. And I read the book and then I was interested in what it was in German. I went to the Wikipedia page and read that and thought, what? who in their right mind decided that is a fitting title? And there are other titles that they came up with, all equally bad, representative of what this actually is.
It's because the joke of the book, or the joke in the book, which is Have Spacesuit Will Travel, is based on an American idiom of like people putting notices on boards, sort of like, oh, I'm a guy, have horse will travel, have shotgun will travel, have briefcase will travel. It's a way to say that, like, you know, I'm experienced in the world and I want a job and don't have to be here. I want to go on again.
I'm free to go.
Yeah, I think there was a TV show called Have Shotgun Will Travel. It was a cowboy, you know, all those cowboy Lone Ranger-y kind of things as well. So that's where the name comes from.
Yeah.
So here's the thing about this book. My own history of reading this book is that this was a favorite book of mine when you're a kid. Getting into it, you're like, people talking about the golden age or the big three of science fiction, mm-hmm. which is sort of people talking about Arthur C. Clarke, Isaac Asimov, and Robert A. Heinlein. And these were the guy, you know, these were the big writers. It even says on Heinlein's Wikipedia page here, I think. So let me just scroll to the top. What does it say here? Yes, he's the big three of English science fiction. So these are always held up as sort of like when you're getting into it. And when I was getting into science fiction in the 90s, these books were just all over the place.
Oh, yeah, makes sense.
Loads of these books. And this was one of his, what do you call it, juvenile novels, his kids' books that he was writing early on. So some of his first novels, like half of his first novels were these children's books.
Yeah.
And then he kind of definitely took a break away from that and started writing more mature books, things like The Moon is a Harsh Mistress, Stranger in a Stranger Land, Starship Troopers, which, while some of them feature young people, they're not kids' books anymore. There's, you know, a lot more blatant politics in them, a lot of sex in them, a lot of talk about religious polity, you know, all these different kind of things. So
yes, makes sense. What's his background?
Robert A. Heinlein, he was an engineer and naval officer in the Second World War.
Okay.
We'll get onto that in a bit.
Yeah.
Either way, what I want to say is that this is a book which is one of, like, an early favorite of mine to be like, oh, it's a fun story with fun characters.
Adventure book.
It's an adventure book. It's very pulpy. It's all about, like, going to the moon and all this kind of thing. Still one of my all-time favorites, but then I look through and there isn't an SFBRP episode about it. So that's why I wanted to check this out. It is listed on the SFBRP episode lists in two places, actually, but it was recorded as an SFF audio podcast with, you know, various people. Let me have a quick look here. So, with Jesse, Seth, Mark, Turetsky, and Tamahomi as well.
Yeah.
So it was a SF audio podcast that then I added to the SFBRP feed as its own thing. And I've done that a few times as well.
Yeah.
We did that with, what does it say here? The Steel Remains, Tarzan of the Apes, The Land That Time Forgot, Oryx and Crake, The Girl Who Was Plugged In, How Spacesuit Will Travel, When the Sleeper Wakes, War of the Worlds, The Lathe of Heaven, and also the one of the other books that we have here in the SFBI, or the Earth Abides by, and there's been a few others there.
Yeah.
So what I was thinking of doing is that these are sitting there, but the links to the episodes is always a bit, you know, a bit chunky, like clunky and things. So what I was thinking of doing is going through some of these books and the books that I enjoy, rereading them, having dedicated SFBRP episodes about them.
Yes.
And then like delisting the SFF audio podcast.
Replacing it with an actual SFBRP.
Yeah, like an actual SFBRP. Yeah. BRP one. So I was thinking of doing that with Tarzan of the Apes, Oryx and Crake, How Spacesuit Would Travel, which is this one, and War of the Worlds, and maybe The Lathe of Heaven, because Ursula K. Le Guin is always worth a reread.
Yes.
And then kind of delisting some of these other ones as well. And the other reason I want to read this is because we've got this long-running project, which is the SFBRP Must Reads list, our attempt at a masterworks list, a canon of science fiction. And I thought this might be, like, this is, again, one of my favorite books. Again, with qualifications, but it's, an influential book.
Yes.
In my own science fiction reading in that way. So, and I thought, yeah, it was worth its own episode and maybe consideration to be added to the SFBRP Must Reads list.
Yes, I think it's a strong contender.
A strong contender, yeah. Okay, so let's get into it. Do you have any opening things to say about this book? Because I'm just like setting it up here of like why are we doing an episode about this now?
I went in completely blank. I had apart from the title,
yeah.
I never got in contact with any of it. I just didn't know anything about it.
Right.
And it was a pleasant read. I think it was because it is written quite lightly, quite like, you know, as a juvenile novel, I think that really worked in its favor. I did understand the groundwork that this book made for other books to work and work in, like the context. It kind of filled up a little context, a missing piece in my context of science fiction.
Yeah.
How it is all interconnected.
Yeah, and that's kind of what I wanted to do with this SFBRP Must Reads list. So even when a book I didn't think was that, it isn't a great novel,
mm-hmm.
some books are like so foundational to like all of the rest of science fiction that comes after it that you go, oh, right, it's kind of worth including. And
yes.
It's exactly the same author, Heinlein,
yes.
with Starship Troopers. It's like, it's difficult to discuss, or it's difficult to appreciate, or it's difficult to fully understand the context of pretty much all other military science fiction without that kind of mindset at the basis, even if the politics isn't agreeable, or, you know, in some cases is repugnant, or whatever you want to say.
Yes.
By having that layer at the bottom, or including it on the list, I think it's kind of like important, not because it's a good book, but important because it is a little bit foundational to
yes.
other books.
And also because generally books are written by people who are older than me, and also to just know what their reading canon
yeah.
must have included, it is kind of like giving a whole, the picture is getting a whole, is becoming whole. And and even if there are no direct references or whatever in other people's books,
yeah.
I'm pretty sure to know that they have read it in their youth.
Right.
It's like a youth.
Yes.
Informative.
This,
yeah.
And let's get onto that as we go through this. So
yeah.
let's just give a rough outline of this book.
Okay.
It's about, what's the name of the character? Let's just bring it up here.
Kip Russell.
Yes. Clifford Russell is determined to go to the moon. Now, what I really like about this is that this is the framing of this is that he's going to travel, and it starts off in his home.
Yes.
And then it goes a bit wider. It goes like to his workplace, and it goes out, out and out. And then he actually gets to the moon. And then after going to the moon, there's an adventure on the moon. And then after they go there, they go to Pluto, and then they go further afield and further afield and further afield again. You know, it's
an expansion.
And it's an expansion. This is a classic frame of like, all right, have some adventures here. Okay, that episode is over. Now let's go to the next episode. Mm-hmm. Almost, it's kind of almost exactly what they do in, you know, in For All Mankind. And this book is a very much a kind of For All Mankind, you know, talking about the Apple TV show there as well. Yes. It starts off in the training and they're learning how to put on spacesuits and all that kind of stuff. And then they get into orbit. And then from there, there's a whole season set on the moon. And then there's a whole season set on Mars. And technology, and they're not in our future, you know. Yeah. It's like their own future. And in this book, this is in the future from 1958 when it was written, talking about people being on the moon again, 11 years before people got to the moon. Yeah. But imagining that, of course, in the future there's going to be moon bases and all that kind of stuff. Of course there is, and that's kind of what the For All Mankind is doing. Like this could be set in 1986 For All Mankind.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, totally.
That's kind of like if this book was set now, like if this was going to be adapted into a TV show, they could just say, hey, guys, okay, we're going to have spaceship wheel travel. We're just going to reuse the same set. Like we've got all these sets here, all these For All Mankind sets.
That can all happen in the background.
But all these, you know, we've got all the special effects assets. We've already got all this. We've got it all sorted out. We know how to do the moonwalking. We know how to do the zero gravity. We know how to do cold stuff. We know how to do, spaceship engineering and spacesuit engineering. That's all ready to go. Let's go. Yeah. And so, yes, it's about Kip, and he meets up with two other characters. One is Pee-wee.
Yes.
Who is someone? It's I really like the start of it. He's sort of like, I want to go to the moon, and he wins a spacesuit. It's all convoluted. It's dumb, but it's perfect children's book
Such
kind
a
of stuff.
Fun story.
Yeah. And he gets into it, and then he's out and about. He's like, well, I'm gonna have to sell this spacesuit, but let's go out, and I'll just use the radio. And he starts calling radio signals, and that attracts someone
playing.
In a spaceship in a UFO.
Out playing with it
in a UFO, and the UFO comes down, picks him up, and he ends up on this moon adventure, and later. Later on, you know, goes further and further afield. And Oscar, which is his name for the spacesuit.
Yeah.
Or is that, I think that was its code, wasn't it? It had a code in it, so like, because it had its own history, you know, it had its history stuff, this discarded spacesuit.
Yeah, it's been used before.
Yeah, it's a well-used spacesuit. And he fixes up this spacesuit, and then that's his companion, one of his other companions along the way. And I like that the spacesuit talks back to him, but not in a magical way. It's sort of like, look, I'm just a bit of your subconscious here. So, like, you think I'm talking back to you, and it's like, yeah, but what do you want me to do? It's sort of like, no, I'm you. Like, it's a fun thing. So he gets to chat with his spacesuit when he's cut off from other people as well. So Pee-wee, so he's like, in this book, he's just going to college. So he's like 18 years old, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. He just applied for further education.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then there's a 9 or 10 year old girl who has been kidnapped, and then he has to save her and things. And yeah, a big science fiction adventure. So let's just discuss now that my really favorite part of this novel, which is everything up until they get to like the last place, like the last scene where they get, you know, where they go over to what's basically Coruscant, which is like the heart, like they get to the Galactic Council or whatever
it
is. There. Everything up until this point, I think, is like just so much fun. It's really, really great.
Okay.
Because as you say, this is like when you see this book in action, you realize why people love The Martian and love Project Hail Mary, and they get turned into, you know, blockbuster movies. It's because what you really like to see is engineering competence porn for like, how do you fix the thing? What you do is these are the steps that you need to fix the thing, and you get competent people in a difficult situation engineering and sciencing their way out of that hole.
Yes. And I find it so refreshing that this happens to two children.
Yeah.
And
well, at the start it isn't with two children.
Yes. Okay. At the start it's him like being really clever, MacGyvering his way.
No. At the start it's his father engineering him. That's the whole point.
Oh, right, okay.
It starts with Kip's father setting him up as a child child rearing as engineering
yes.
problem
yes.
and setting it up. And then they're like, and now you want to win this spacesuit. How are you going to win this spacesuit?
Yes.
And he sets it up by like, you know, how do you game the system is pretty much what it is. Like, there's this competition.
Yeah.
How are you going to game the system to win a trip to the moon? Because that's the main prize, is you can win a trip to the moon. And then other prizes are like, oh, you can get this old spacesuit that we have. We got this batch of old spacesuits and we're going to give them out as second prizes.
But that's not his goal. His goal is
to get to the moon.
Yeah.
I mean, it works out anyway. But here's the thing. You know, he gets the whole village helps him. Like, he engineers, he socially engineers
yes.
the entirety of his town with his job at the pharmacy selling soap to engineer how much. And he spends a lot of money and it's a lot of engineering to win I'm going to take a trip to the moon competition.
Yes, it's very good.
What appeals to me of this is, before I ever read this book, this was me. If there was something that I could game to get around something at school to get a grade, I was like, well, I know how I'm going to do this, or, you know, get a result, I would do it. There's this one thing where, do you know about the wisdom of the crowds? This idea of wisdom of the crowds is that if you just get lots and lots and lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of people to estimate something.
Oh, yes.
The average of lots and lots and lots and lots of people estimating something
gets
closer to an exact result than if you ask one expert. Or it's more likely that the average of lots of people estimating, like lots of unknowledgeable people estimating something. And I remember once I was at this, you know, it was at this farm event kind of thing. And there was this one game, which was guess how many sweets are in the jar.
Mm.
And everybody had written down how many sweets are in the jar.
Okay, so it was accessible data.
And it was on a big sheet. And I sat down and I was like, and this was before I even knew about the term wisdom of the crowds. Because I was like, you know, probably I would say 12 years old or whatever.
Yeah.
And so I'm like, all right, what I need to do is just do the average of everybody else's done. So I went through and I counted it up. There was probably like, you know, it was like an A4 sheet of paper lined and then split into two halves. I picture it now in my head. This is from when I was like 11 or 12 years old. So it's really, really cool. So it was these two columns, right? And I went through both of the columns and I added it all up and I divided it by how many people doing it. And I entered it in and it was like, I don't know, like 61. And the result that I got was 61.5.
Okay.
No, it was like 61.7. I remember because it was above five. So it was 61.7.
Yeah.
And so I put down 61.7. I didn't put down a whole number. That being too clever and not putting down a whole number came back to bite me. Because what they then did is the result was they took it out, counted them, and I was within 0.3 of whatever it was.
Yeah.
And they were just sort of like, oh, I just discarded it. And then somebody else was within another. So I was actually close. I can't remember how it was, but I was closer to the actual result.
Yeah.
By, you know, I got within 0.3 of it, but somebody else. And they just went and they would just split it. And then they flipped a coin and I lost the coin flip. And then that was it. And I was like, oh, I was closer than anybody else by, like, rediscovering from first principles the wisdom of the crowds kind of average out everybody's thing. And
but at the same time,
what?
You learned another lesson.
I learned another lesson. Don't try and be too clever. Don't try and be too clever. What I should have done is, if I was in between the two of them, what I should have done is been entered twice. It was only like 20 pence to enter or whatever it was. Should have entered twice, one with 67 and one with 68.
Yeah.
And been like, those are my two guesses. I would have been the one person within 68 because somebody had 69. I had 67.7 or whatever it was. So we like the actual number was between the two whole numbers, but instead of saying my guess was closer because I, you know, was within 0.3, the two. Either way, what I'm trying to say is this book appeals to me because I'm going to engineer my way out of a problem, which you shouldn't think of as an engine. Like, why would this be an engineering problem? But when you get down to it, most things are an engineering problem, be it actual engineering, just applicable maths and knowledge, or in the case of this book, social engineering, where he social engineers his way to, you know, getting everybody's soap wrappers to be able to win the competition.
Yeah.
And things like that.
Yes.
So
I think the beginning is a very good beginning And I really like the relationship he has with his father. Like, oh no, let me put it this way.
I think it's horrific.
Let me rephrase that, because that's not actually what I want to say. Is that the idea that he is brought up by this really clever person, obviously.
Yeah.
Creates a sort of independent thinking that it is difficult to achieve if you don't force your child to do it. There has to be a certain I'm not going to help you.
Yeah.
You can't. If you want to do that, you have to do it by yourself.
Should we finish off this? Should we skip to the end and carry on with this engineering, bringing up children as engineering challenge section? Because I was going to address my major problems with this at the end of the podcast.
Let's do it at the end then. I don't know your plan. So.
Okay, well, let's move on. Okay, let's address some of this at the end. Okay.
Okay.
We can talk about it now. Like, if you want to talk about this, you said this is an interesting, a good relationship with his parents.
No. Okay. I immediately went back.
Okay, let's immediately get into this here. I think this is one of the most horrific stories of child abuse that I've ever seen, in that this is meant to be like Kip is like, yes, he's good. He's going to turn out to be one of the good ones. I see this as horrific parenting by literally everybody around him. It's awful. But it's only revealed at the end of the book how awful it was. It seems like his father is just like this curmudgeon, like, well, I don't agree with how you're being educated in school, so you've got to educate yourself. Mm-hmm. Like, he's pretty much saying, when I went to school, like, you know, Kip says, I was at school, but I wasn't really learning anything from school. It was my own studies.
Yes.
Again, that reflects my childhood almost exactly, because... Mm-hmm. Every break and lunchtime, I would just go to the library and read books and go to the computer room and play around on the computer and all of this kind of stuff. That's what I did at school. I gamed the system.
It reminded me a lot of you.
And so, again, I see myself. But the point is, that was me deciding to do that rather than my father forcing me to do it. It's revealed at the end of the book that... when his father was saying, oh, well, have you applied to college and do you have enough money? How are you going to pay to get to college and all this kind of stuff? It turns out his father has already set up a fund to pay for his college. His college is already paid for.
Mm-hmm.
But his father puts him through this whole like song and dance game playing kind of thing to see what he would do on his own initiative to try and get into college, or like how he would try and get into college. It turns out he gets into college miraculously by a space adventure and then meeting important people from the, you know, the future UN or whatever it is, and gets a placement in MIT and it's all paid for with a scholarship, so this fund isn't even needed.
No.
But that his father was secretly had paid for his college, told him that he hadn't paid for his college, told him to sort out his own entry into college and how he's going to finance his way at college, then reveals at the end of the book, psych, your college has been paid for this entire time. This entire thing was just a like weird test. I know this is a children's story. It's a fairy story. All of these things happen, you know, like you're the best kid in the school and in the end you end up running the school, or you're the best kid on the spaceship and this whole thing has been a test and that now you're going to be captaining the spaceship. You know, this stuff happens all the time in young adult fiction and children's fiction.
Yeah.
But when it's actually revealed at the end, it's... I don't know. It's just horrific and awful, because it takes away like all of the thing that you think he's been working for and all of his intelligence that he's had. It turns out that it's not in him. It's like and it's revealed that his father like slept with one of his students and that's where he comes from. And his father was like he comes from an inappropriate relationship between a professor and the professor's star student. So that's why he's intelligent. It's all like this, you know, genetic essentialism kind of thing that like, actually, no, he is the successful outcome of his father's child rearing as engineering experiment. And for me, that is like weirdly problematic and icky and makes me enjoy the rest of the book less. You know, mm-hmm. It casts the rest of the book in a different light for me. The actual outcome, what's actually happened in his story is a lot less satisfying than, say, my own story, where my parents, like, I wouldn't say didn't care what I did at school or anything, but like they instilled a family home environment which allowed me to be able to be you know, curious and do what I want and follow my own dreams and follow my own background, you know, and follow my own interests, which leads me to become a professional juggler. Yeah. Kip wasn't allowed to be. Like, he could have had that same childhood. And in the end, and it's hinted that actually he doesn't want to go to become a lawyer and a leader and, you know, and marry Pee-wee in the future. He just goes, oh, no, I want to do an engineering problem. Like, I want to solve spacesuits. Like, I've got some good ideas about spacesuits.
Yeah.
Let me just solve that. And that's and it's kind of... It's kind of acknowledged that that's not good enough for him. Like his parent, like how good his parents are, how rich his parents are, how connected his parents are, and Pee-wee's parents and the new people that he's met, like these world leading, you know, Secretary General of the future UN. It's like, no, you can't just aspire to be an engineer. It has to be something greater.
You can't waste your potential. That's always what it is about, isn't it?
The richness of life comes from the availability to be able to become an engineer, to be able to become a designer, to be able to become a lawyer or a doctor, and then decide, no, I want to be an artist. I want to be an entertainer. I want to be a juggler or a comedian or musician or whatever I want to do. And I think the message of this book, which is it's correct to set children up to be engineered into the perfect future career for them and life story, is like, in the end, that's kind of like the message of the book. And but up until the very end, I didn't think that. It was sort of like, oh, this kid didn't have enough structure. His father said, here's some structure for you. He worked in it and got to where he wanted to go. But the reveal of the book is that that's not quite exactly what happened.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. No, I get that. At the beginning, I had different ideas about this as well.
Yeah.
And the only thing that I noticed, I didn't notice really the end. I didn't connect because the beginning is so far away from the end. So much happened that it's just not so clear in my head anymore. But what I thought was that the anxiety, that the trauma of this, hey, we don't have the money, you have to earn the money yourself, was a huge burden on him.
Yeah.
Like he constantly went back to, and I'm going to pay back and I'm going to do, I'm going to work, I'm going to do
just
all
imagine
this.
Like, oh, I've got this spacesuit is the thing that brings me the most joy in the world, me working on a spacesuit.
And I have to give it back to get the money.
To be afford a one semester of tuition, I'm going to have to sell the thing that brings me the most joy in the world. And his father is like, yeah, that's it. That's what you have to do. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the one kind person, which is the owner of the pharmacy that he works at, is sort of like, hey, you should get into pharmacy because, you know, I'm always looking for someone to take over my shop when I'm doing
it. He really believes in him.
He really believes in him. And, of course, he's not interested in pharmacy. He's like going to do organic chemistry or whatever he needs to do to do that. But the opportunity is there. But it's like that's like a positive opportunity that's being offered to him rather than this weird negative opportunity to his father. I'm sort of like, Heinlein, were you beaten as a child or what was taken away from you or what was like removed from you that you thought you should have some opportunity but didn't and you resented your father for it? But in the end, his father comes off as like, yes, and if it wasn't for my father, I wouldn't have been on this adventure. You know what would have been better? Him not being on that adventure.
Yeah.
You know, better, you know, it's seen as a positive that he had these skills to almost die many, many times and in the end jeopardize the entire future of humanity.
Yeah.
And this is seen as a parenting win for, it seems like Heinlein is saying that this is a parenting win. Kip is like, because he's an idiot and he doesn't have any like social intelligence, doesn't understand any of this. His brain is all working at another level.
Yeah.
But if my parents had like wasted my time, in fact, this is what happened with me, that I was brought up, I know in a weird way to say this, but I was brought up religious and I was brought up as a fundamental Christian. And like thousands of hours of my life was spent going to church and going to this. And, you know, some good things happened to that. But I had a frank conversation with my father years later saying that, like, I kind of, like, I will put it this way. I was saying I have to work against being actively resentful for you as my parents for putting me in this situation where I was at this youth fellowship, which was like this kind of cult-like adventure not adventure, like this. It was just this weird situation of people having power over me, of my time and my energy and my thoughts, which looking back is like super resentful. And it's come out that, of course, some of the leadership of this youth fellowship have now been taken to court and are convicted of, you know, sex crimes against the young women. And it's just sort of like, oh, I was just put in that situation by my parents in a super not good way. And I have to kind of like try and separate that out, because if I look at it like, if looking at it objectively, that is objectively terrible parenting from my parents. Mm. But like I can acknowledge that, if you know what I mean. Like it took me years, but I had to acknowledge that my parents were very bad parents for putting me in this bad situation, this bad social construct, which was this youth fellowship, yeah, this fundamental Christian youth fellowship that we went to, which is just, it's just horrific, you know.
Yes.
Looking back now.
Yeah, looking back. But in the situation, I'm sure they...
Well, they were trying to do the best thing.
Yes.
They're Christians and they're like, well, of course we want our
kids. Oh, there's a community and we can give our kids to the community and they experience all the things.
It cut me off from social groups at school, you know, cut me off from friends and everything, because I just wasn't like all of the things that you'd think coming along with growing up Christian and in your entire school are like six Christians.
Oh, right.
And you're one of the six Christians
in the
school.
You're one of the weird ones.
You're one of the weird ones. Yeah, like, so I didn't have, like, again, a normal child. That led to me having the life that I do now in many ways. But it's not like Kip is like going, oh, well, yes, I guess my father was lying to me and manipulating to me and never told me about this thing. And I didn't have any, curiosity about this thing. And he was someone who slept with one of his, he was a professor who slept with one of his students, then married her. And that's where I am. And like, none of that was revealed to him at the start. This kind of like really weird, icky parenting thing. It's only revealed right at the very end of the book. And it kind of spoils it for me, because it feels like Kip is kind of self-made at the start.
Yes.
Not safe-made. Self-made, but
against,
like,
all the odds.
Yeah, he kind of grows into himself as a person, and at the end I'm like,
yeah. I always thought that the pharmacist acted as a sort of primary father figure to him, and at the end I must have maybe misunderstood a bit of the end, because I understood that the pharmacist had saved up some money and was willing to give it to him
it's because he was growing old and wanted to retire
he was trying to give
Kip the pharmacy. No, but at the end it's a different thing, so
okay.
It says, well, what does it actually say here? I can't find it right away, but it pretty much just said that, oh, he had hinted at pharmacy school, but never this. Like, this is Kip saying, I'm not going to pharmacy school. And only last night, Dad had told me that he had bought an education policy for me the day I was born. He had been waiting to see what I would do on my own. It's like one sentence.
Because he's talking about he.
Yeah, he hinted at that. The pharmacy school...
I assumed that the pharmacy guy bought that
for him. It says, and only last night, Dad had told me that he bought an education policy. So at the end of the book, I don't mind, this happens in children's books, that at the end, you become the prince and everything's laid on for you. And, you know, you win the girl and you win the prize and everything's set up. And that's what happens here. Like, everybody just goes out of their way to make everything as easy as possible for him at the end. And he takes all of that privilege and then throws a milkshake in a guy's face. Whatever. It's a bit disappointing. Anyway, let's move on. Let's get on to the fun engineering part as well, the next bit, which is you get to the moon and you fix up the spacesuit, you get to the moon, you've got to go across. Now this is perfect, you know, this is like reading a chapter of The Martian by Andy Weir, because it's like, right, I've got this spacesuit and I've got this valve and I've got this other valve and I've got to put it in and I've got to equalize the pressure and we've got to do
it's
this.
It's practical engineering.
Yeah, it's always practical. And you've got to navigate and sort of like, well, if I look at the Earth, I can see
and
the
angles.
And you
need knowledge of things and calculations and all those
just,
kind of
it's
stuff.
It's just all of this stuff. And a lot of it is like unimaginable that anybody could have that many facts in their head.
Yeah.
But I guess if that's your main thing, if that's your main, like all you've been doing is wanting to go to the moon and do spacesuit repair, like, you're going to have all of this in your head.
Yes.
But it is very much like, oh, Andy Weir, no, not Andy Weir, what's his name? Mark Watney on the moon just happens to be the expert he just happens to be the botanist or whatever. No, yeah. What is it?
He's mainly the botanist.
Yeah, and also he's the main engineer. And also it's sort of like, oh, so all of the skills that he perfectly needed to survive on the Mars for 2 years by himself, like he knew how to grow the potatoes and he knew how to repair the spacesuit and get the radios working. And that's all this is. It's sort of like, all right, we've got to get the radio working. We've got to get this stuff. So this is definitely precursor to Andy Weir. Okay. Then when they get to Pluto, he's sort of like, well, how long does it take to get from here to there? And he's doing his like, I'm in a room, how can I determine where I am? And he's sort of like, well, what is gravity like and what is the day like? And he does the opening of like Project Hail Mary, where like, well, I wake up, I'm in a room, I need to determine, am I where I think I am, or where am I where I think I am, you know? And he's working out gravity and he's working out time and he's calculating in his head these long things. He says, if I had a slide rule, I could do this straight away, but I had to do it in my head and I came up with two different answers, then I had to confirm which of the two different answers was least wrong and stuff. And it's a very Mark Watney the Martian slash whatever Mark Watney's name is when he's on Project Hail Mary, you know. He's doing that. This is the kind of science fiction that Andy Weir is very specifically hailing back to with Project Hail Mary and The Martian and his other one, Artemis or whatever, which is set on the moon. This is what he's doing. So in the time when everybody else is sort of like, hey, let's talk about politics or let's do this, and we're talking about empire in this book and, you know, game theory in this book, and there's all these different things with, oh, we're going to talk about social stuff and gender and identity and all these, you know, sexuality, all these things that these other people were talking about, like, in, you know, in the last 15 years of science fiction, Andy Weir is like, well, let's just do Heinlein, let's just do like space engineering and like remove this kind of stuff and put this in. So that's what this book is. I'm not saying that Andy Weir read this book and that's what it is, but this is the most, like, some of this book is like the most Andy Weir segments that you can like trace it back to, if you know what I mean.
Because of the practical engineering that you have to do in situations, there's not a lot of theoretical thinking.
Yes, it's engineering prowess as superpower to get your way out of science fiction-y situations.
For sure, for sure.
So,
Want to talk about, I have two things in my head
go for it.
About this book. First of all, I think Pee-wee, or Patricia is actually her name.
Yeah, you only discovered that right at the end.
Yes. She is a very important part and a very important character. And I do appreciate her character study, or like the way that she is described as. First of all, she's younger than Kip. But also she is on an equal level. She's full of knowledge curiosity, and
she's the precocious tomboy, overachieving hothouse child.
She has, I mean, I wouldn't say no inhibitions, in the sense of that she has no sense of, I better shouldn't do this.
Right.
So she goes ahead and does that and saves the day in lots of situations.
But she's impulsive and saves the day.
Yes.
And Kip is calculated and saves the day.
Yes. So it's a good pairing of characters here. And I really enjoyed the whole story, because it felt at some points more like he's taking care of his little sister.
Yeah.
And I kind of... also like that she went through all the stages of, I have to be strong and help him and do the stuff. But at the same time, we find out she sits in her room and cries.
Yeah, this is, but there's some really great reveals about that.
Doesn't want him to know about it. And I think this is...
But also, that's him learning social intelligence to see her crying, decide to creep away, and then he comes back noisily. And because he's noisily, she wipes her tears away and she's like, hey, how are you doing? Yes, everything's going here fine. And he's like, well, I know that she's been crying, but I don't want her to know that I know that she's been crying, and it's better for her if she doesn't think that I know that she's that exactly the same kind of thing.
Yes,
that is him slowly grasping what it means to be around other people and other humans.
Yes.
Because up until then, he's sort of like, I don't think you should. And then we did anyway. Or like, he's always going, well, no, of course, I'm the man here, so I should do this. And then she leads the way and he's sort of like, yeah, it was better that she led the way. She was more knowledgeable about this anyway.
And I really like this book, especially in the context of what is currently happening in young men spheres, you know, manosphere and the kind of looks maxing and what all the stuff is going
on. All the stuff that you see that I'm completely oblivious to because I don't see that stuff.
Absolutely. So however, it's like, it's all the things about a young man reflecting on what it actually means to be a man.
Right.
Or like what it means to be manly or, you know, all these kind of things in comparison to a younger girl / woman. I mean, you can scale it up. It doesn't really matter at that point. And the things he's learning here are so important because he does learn that if there is someone, like in this respect, Pee-wee has been on the moon before.
Yeah,
so she has more experience.
Yeah.
So he can't just stand there and say, yes, I will lead because I'm the man. That doesn't, in this real life context, has no real meaning because at that point it is not about who's the man, who's not the man. It is about we need to survive this.
Yeah.
And the only thing that counts is experience.
Right, yeah.
And it doesn't matter who at that point
has the experience.
Has that.
Yeah.
And so he learns that it is more important to acknowledge and respect the person in front of you. And he learns that he learns to adjust his own expectations on when he when he thinks he's right and when he thinks he should lead.
Yeah.
And he gives her the respect that she deserves. And I really like that in this book, that is the underlying story that is being told between the two of them. And I really appreciated these bits where they both learn from each other and with each other and respect each other. And sometimes Pee-wee wants to be so strong that she almost dies.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so you have these really subtle learning experiences for the two of them, which I really appreciate.
Yeah, it's a fun dynamic that they get to trust what each other does.
Yes.
As they go through.
And what each other, what the other knows, and if when the other knows more.
Yeah, it's, in that way, I think this is, like I say, most of the way through, this is like a really good children's, like fairy tale kind of thing, sort of like about, you know, relying on other people and acknowledging other people's.
Even if they're younger.
They
yeah,
even
if
younger,
they are a different gender. Yes. Yeah. And at the beginning, it was really funny because the first time they meet, he wasn't sure if she was a girl or a boy.
Yeah.
And I think that really shows the whole dynamic.
But I think it is a really fun, you know, like you say, it's like suddenly having to look after a little sister.
Yeah.
Which I think is a really good thing. It's sort of like, oh, if he'd have had a brother or a sister, this would be a very different, like him learning about that stuff would be very different. But because he's an only child, and I guess she's an only child as well. Anyway, there's definitely that's kind of needed. You know, you need other people to bounce off and work with.
Because he is an only child, he hasn't learned that, and it's something that you have to learn. You don't suddenly grow up knowing all these things. It's a social learning experience, and I really appreciated that.
And the other thing that you want to say?
Up until the very end, I was always really, hoping that it wouldn't go into this weird kind of, oh, and then it turns out they are in love with each other and whatever. It would have been weird.
Yes.
First of all, because of the age.
The thing is, it is weird because Pee-wee's father pretty much says, look,
you're destined for each other.
It's sort of like, I will do the creepy grooming for you on my 10-year-old daughter.
Yeah.
For you, the age, what does it say? The age gap isn't too much. Like, it's only an 8-year age gap. And I'm just sort of like, I'm sort of like, well, you're already the offspring of a creepy age gap professor and student relationship. And I'm just sort of like, no, Heinlein, why do you have to put this in your book?
Exactly. Yeah. So that was
meant to be the children's book.
That was
don't
a bit
put in creepy stuff. There's, you know, all the way through the book, they're like, yes. And you're sort of like, you've got yourself a younger sister, you know, as it goes through. And
they look at each other equal, respectful.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, the one character that brings it in is the adult in the room. And I think, no.
Because he acknowledges of like, well, no, she's more intelligent than me. She's clever. Yeah. And he's all like, no, you're more intelligent. She's a girl. You're more intelligent.
Yeah.
You're good. You're good, like, mating materials so we can have, so you, like, my super child, intelligent offspring, and your father and his star students, super intelligent offspring, can get together and we can genetically engineer and breed the master race of yes. even more intelligent people. And I'm like, stop it.
Yes.
Don't positive eugenics your way into super intelligent people.
It's very weird. And so that was a bit disappointed.
Yes.
A bit disappointed. And the other thing that I have
right.
is a little bit, some bits reminded me of Shroud. Mainly.
By Adrian Tchaikovsky.
Yes, by Adrian Tchaikovsky that we talked about. Mainly the sections where they are on their ways. Like when they are
traveling
or it is not lots of things happening, but they have to do something. Yeah. So I don't even remember how long it was their travel from the spaceship when they left and went to the moon station where they thought they could get help and stuff. And I was like, really?
Yeah, it's a long trek across the moon,
and it keeps going. And that reminded me a bit of what happened with Shroud. There was a few too many.
It's a bit too much of a slog sometimes.
Too much of a slog. And at the end, I thought they would find something.
Yeah, but no, they just continue on.
And they continue on, and then they are there, and then they are...
It's about traveling, it's about going.
It's a little bit... There's a few too many of those stations.
All right, let's talk about some of the end of this book then.
Yeah.
The politics at the end. We talked about the child raising and like ickiness there. The thing that I find weird is that all the way through, the mother thing is meant to be like a hero. Mm. And in the end, she's like an SS agent, Gestapo kind of style for the big space fascist, empire, totalitarian thing.
Are they?
Yeah, because it's literally, yeah, like the politics of the space council at the end and how they treated the worm face planet. First of all, I don't think they kill all the, they genocide or xenocide. They holocaust the entire worm face planet.
But it's revealed
that there's still some worm faces left over on the moon. I'm like, I know this has been working for a million years, but you shouldn't leave behind remnants of people that you tried to genocide. Mm. Like, don't leave behind like genocide remnant populations, because if they get more power in the future, they're going to be like
angry.
So the book is pretty much saying that the hero that gives people like the feel good thing that they put on the foreheads and feel good is an agent of like a super problematic fascist space empire, which is patrolling the rest of the galaxy and subduing things and genociding entire planets to make sure that they're not a threat in the future. Preemptive strikes. It's like the politics is awful here. But here's the thing. It's presented as, yeah, but they're more technologically advanced and have been around longer. So, of course, that's the way the world works and the human race just has to do it. And in 20,000 years' time, we'll be assessed again. And that's what we're just going to have to live with. And I'm like, this is dark. Like, it is super dark at the end of this book. But the mother thing is like, the mother thing will be always looking after us. And like, she's the judge and jury and executioner of humanity. Like, this mother thing is holding the whole of the human race in her hands to be able to wipe them out at the merest whim, and they're like, yes, but we've got this thing that comforts her and makes us feel good. And I'm like, that's like a Nazi giving you a thing which makes you feel good, and then you're treating them as a mother thing, as a caring parent, when they're not. It's like super super colonial. People don't understand how bad it is, you know, kind of. Anyway, it's weird. That's what
I know.
Saying.
However. And here's now my turn to my reading of this council thing. It is nothing different to how humans are.
That's a good thing, is it?
No, it isn't. But why, and I think I really appreciated all the analogies with like humans, if they have ants or if they have rodents,
they kill them all off.
Like it's nothing because they are the animals. And just because something is a higher level than humans.
I know, but here's the thing.
And it's just representative of how humans act towards animals.
Yeah, but here's the thing. If I was now the human race and I knew that us as a human race were going to be reassessed in 20,000 years time, and one way it could go is that our entire planet's going to be destroyed or our entire civilization is going to be destroyed. And the other way it's going to go is if we are meek enough and slot into the way that the three galaxies, fascist overlords want us to be, then we'll be allowed to keep existing as long as we're subservient enough and not enough of a threat. I know it's weird to say this. I'd be like, right, let's start ramping up. We need to expand to every part. We need to get this technology. We need to get up some defenses. We need to do the time travel thing so we can go back and win the time war against them. Like me as a human, straight away, I'm like, oh, I don't want to stick a mother thing against my head, like a mother thing orb against my head and be comforted by these people. Like I would try and, set up a religion to engineer a way that humanity might have a chance of not being annihilated and not also be subservient to the three galaxies. I'll be like, how can we leave? Is there a way to get to another galaxy? Like, can we get this technology and leave and go to another galaxy where these guys are in charge? You know, it's like,
I understand that approach.
I'm just saying, theoretically, if you game it through, humanity shouldn't just be like, oh yes, we'll be fine with this, you know, Gestapo SS agent looking after us. We call her the mother thing. It's all like, yeah, she's using mind tricks on you to keep you subservient. Like, what are you even doing? Like, what's the message?
I understand the whole situation where they were on Vega.
Yeah.
That was all a bit weird.
Yeah.
But I think it is such an amazing analogy towards humans themselves.
Yeah, but I'm like,
and
I'm like, as the humans, I'm like, do you not understand that you're the colonized here and that you need to like work out how to rise up and something. I don't know. It's just like, that's the thing that comes to me.
But then for me, it always reflects on, doesn't that have any sort of consequences of how humans are acting? Humans can't continue act like this.
Yeah.
And we are seeing like, and I, the weird thing, the older I get and the more I learn about the world and the way that humans interact and act and stuff, the more I get disillusioned about without reading science fiction, just living in the world, I get more and more disillusioned about the human existence and is it even worth, like, what are we even doing? But this would give the opportunity to reflect on
it's so funny that the Americans in the book, no reflection at all about that. They're like, no, like this is written from someone who's sort of like, yes, we just won the Second World War, we now do it, and it's in a weird future where the UN isn't in control anymore, and I'm like, oh, this new like and he says there's a League of Nations, then the UN, and now the Federation of something. I'm like, oh, so it's just American fascism as one has it Heinlein, and now the Americans are running stuff. They give someone a Dutch name, but it's sort of like, oh right, now like we're just in charge here and we're all powerful. And it's only revealed at the end of the book that this is like a precursor to like Starship Troopers, where there's like some fascist government in charge of the whole world. You're like, oh, up until the end of this book, like, it's when it's a fun space adventure, and like right up until like the almost to the last chapter, I'm like, this is great. Like, if it was just up until the end of the, you know, the jury, yes, you know, the trial,
and then they go back,
and then it's sort of like, and then I went home, and it was just sort of like, and I had some opportunities. Like, it turns out my father had already paid for me to go, and my father had already sorted out my tuition.
Yes,
The pharmacist is hinting that he will pay for me to go get training and then become a pharmacist. But also because of this, someone is going to give me access to MIT that my father's already, like, it's going to work out. And all I need to do is decide which one of those I could be. Or which one of those, like, I've got these three different opportunities, or maybe I want to make my own way. And it ends with him just disregarding the feelings of the people around him and becoming a performative bully. Mm. And I'm like, oh, Oh, he's learned the wrong... He's learned that, like, what he is now is the worst of the things that he has seen before. He grows up. He grows up to be a stooge of the fascist government, or he grows up to be, you know, skinny or fatty or whatever those guys are. Like,
yes.
And this is shown as like a moment of triumph. And yes. That's another thing that this book is really doing groundwork for, which is this... This sensibility that comes through in American science fiction, which is the punch the air, you go girl, yay moment in a lot of these science fiction books, where if you have any reflection of it at all, it just makes you think, oh, this is horrific. You know, the way your attitude to other people and your attitude of politics and your attitude is horrific. But because it is the main character doing it, it is seen as a moment of triumph.
Yes.
Whereas if any other character had done this, it's sort of like, yes, and he should have been eaten and turned into soup. Mm-hmm. And it was probably the best thing that they ever did. Their greatest day was when they were being eaten by aliens. And I get to the end of this book and I'm like, Kip, you are very, very close for your greatest day being you being eaten by aliens. Mm-hmm. And you'll probably love her for it because it's the mother thing and she's going to eat you, but she's mind controlled you with a device that you're willingly put to your forehead to be willingly drugged by your overlord here, and yeah, you're just gonna, you know, walk your way into the situation. And so much of, again, I don't want to say all of American science fiction, I'm just saying I see so many examples of this over and over again. And a book which was on the SFBRP must reads list, which was The Fifth Season by M.K. Jemisin. Mm. I took it off, not because it's a bad book, but because it's like, it's because it's just fantasy. It just didn't, I realize it doesn't fit within the scope of the list there. But also in there, you're sort of like, oh, these people who have superpowers and like literal superpowers, like super magical powers to control things, just people dying and then being bullies, and then like, oh, and it just so happened I had to kill dozens of people just to get through this situation. Oh, and here I was just careless and then destroyed an entire town that had been there for this, you know, this many, you know, dozens of years they'd gone through, and my own carelessness just destroyed the town and I'm moving on. I'm like, oh, there is this, I don't know, this like, well, I'm special, I'm clever, I'm the protagonist here. And I think I mentioned it in the previous episodes where I was taking it, sort of like, how many people have to die for my own growth and story arc to be there? But those people who die are unacknowledged. And I see, you know, you see
and
it.
And they deserve it.
And I've mentioned this a number of times, and it doesn't always make the book worse.
Yeah.
It just makes it like alien to me, yeah, in a way which I feel disappointed that it isn't, like, that stuff isn't rectified, like it, that is still isn't acknowledged. And this book is a children's book in an American children's book from 1958. The kind of attitude that it has there, that's displayed in the last chapter of the book, I think is unfortunately foundational to a lot of modern science fiction. It's still there under all of these Tor Wave books, even books which I mostly enjoy. There's still the scene where somebody, like, what was that book? I can't remember what it was, but there were some people, two magical people on a boat, and everyone on the boat is really afraid of them because they're afraid that these people might just accidentally murder them because they're so powerful as magic people. And the triumphant moment where it's a real moment of growth for these two characters is that they murder everyone on the ship, go off and go and have a sex scene together. And I'm like, oh, so you are the embodiment of the worst thing that everybody around you suspected of it.
Yeah.
And you as an author are writing this as a hero triumphant moment in the book. And me, as someone who identifies more with other people around the powerful people with all the magical powers, like literal connections to the most powerful people on Earth, their entire future has been paid for. Their entire future has been worked out for them. They literally have people queuing up to give them the best things in life, which is connections, which is money, which is education, which is everything. And then you don't recognize that the bully doesn't have your same thing. And the book ends with a moment of triumph for you, which is empowerment and elevation of yourself over somebody who is less fortunate than you, because there's no way that the bully has got a good home life and is in a better situation than that. And Kip has zero empathy for the bullies and 100% confidence in might makes right.
I'm better.
Yeah. My intelligence makes me better. My money makes me better. My connections make me better. My past actions make me better. And it's really unfortunate that that is in the book, but that is also, weirdly, at the basis of a lot of science fiction. Again, especially science fiction from America, from people who have privileged people in America,
yeah,
who haven't fully examined their upper middle class roots in a way which is, I know, unfortunate that it's still there. Again, I don't want to cast all science fiction about that, but that's what I want to say.
I want to say that I sometimes read this, like, it also comes up, you know, in Ender's Game, this kind of stuff, where an author writes something and sometimes it feels to me like they want the reader to actually see exactly that point.
Yeah.
And they want them to be aware and start self-reflecting on, oh, if I just think that now just because my hero or the person I think of as the hero in this thing does that, doesn't make this action suddenly heroic and good.
Yeah, but this is a
children's book. But it gets lost. I think it gets lost in many ways. And then it becomes a self-perpetuating, oh, that's always what the hero does.
Yeah.
They take what that was done
the
to them.
The hero should literally kill the bully in Ender's Game.
Yes.
Sort of like, it's okay if somebody is stronger than you and you're cleverer than them and you're obviously being, you know, groomed or like raised to be in a position of power. It's okay to literally kill the bully.
Yes. And it becomes this self-perpetuating...
Ender's Game says, not quite okay.
Yes. And that is the kind of nuance that I think over time gets lost in the books.
Yes.
That people read this as, you know, how we've talked about this many times, especially also in the juggling. We've talked about the performance of juggling, how people look at a performance and think, oh, I have to do these and these and these motions, and then I get that and that reaction. But they don't reflect the context and where emotion comes from and how it is related to the actions.
Yeah,
and that is what happens in
it's
in
cargo
lots of...
culting the kind of thing. It's sort of like, well, if I just do the same thing that this other book does, I will also have success.
Exactly.
In this.
And so the nuance that once was there, that once was showing, okay, we have to be subtle. There has to be some black and like some gray areas. There's not only black and white. You can't just, it's like the, we the baddies? It's like that same notion.
In the end, when you actually read through and you compile what Heinlein is talking about, it's weird that now the two books of his, which we've considered to be worthy of adding to the SFBRP must reads list, at the base of them have like pretty like not great politics or not great vibes at the whatever you want to say at the bottom.
Yes.
But it is I wouldn't say foundational, but it does explain a lot, especially in this case, which is a children's book.
Yes.
And you're like, oh, you're saying there's missing subtlety. The point is, children's books shouldn't always be subtle.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the, I heard someone say on a podcast recently, I can't remember who said it, but you know, one of the podcasts I listened to saying that I don't like these remakes or these Disney remakes because it always casts the villains as people who are just misunderstood or misunderstood something like this or how about this. It's like, no, but the real story, like the real purpose of a lot of these fairy tales is to say, no, the wolf isn't misunderstood. Mm-hmm. With the wolf is representative of men who will rape you and or whatever it's going to be, like whatever the story is going to be. And it's not like, oh, but the wolf is just, we could just become friends with the wolf. It's like, no, this is a tale to say you've got to look out for people who are actually bad and don't have your best interest in heart, and it doesn't matter how much you try and understand them, that oh, they were brought up as a child and they're whatever, like something like, is it sort of like, no, but you should also try and defeat bad people and stay away from bad people and be wary of bad people, you know.
I understand, but the thing is that we now know as society that is not actually how it works, because you know what, your father is more likely to be the wolf right next to you. You don't even notice.
And so the misunderstood stepfather and what is it, the ugly stepsisters or whatever it is,
yes,
the, that was to say that, you know, there's also one of those things that I was like, yes, people close to you, you know, like there are like family members are often the evil ones. The family members are the ones that you might have to fight back against as well. Look, what I'm trying to say is that in a children's book, adults get hold of these children's stories, and when they do the Disney remakes, they want to make everything a bit more subtle and more shades of grey.
Yeah.
Whereas the original intent of these is when you were living 400 years ago in a forest in Germany. First of all, there were wolves.
Yeah.
Second of all, there were bad people around that. And this is a way to pass down folk wisdom about dealing with bad things in life. We don't have the enough bad things in life to... For a story to resonate with a child to say, hey, you know those evil people who are like trying to beat you and put you in a factory and make you a slave and all that kind of stuff. And the kids these days are like, no, what are you talking about?
Yes.
Like, you know, Disney can't make $1 billion on a movie like trying to go, hey, you know how when you're a child you're really hungry and your parents are beating you and you wish they were dead? And so you want to go on an adventure away from those people? And the kids these days are like, no, what are you talking about? Yeah. No, I have enough food. My parents don't beat me.
And the thing is that I think these stories from the old stories and also like this book.
From the 1950s.
From the 1950s. They should stay as they are. But I think we should also add certain contexts to them.
No, just and write new stories for children these days.
No. Yes. Okay. Let's put aside children's stories and whatever. Right. Yes. I think like there have been lots of things about, you know, how the Struwwelpeter these really horrific stories.
Yeah.
And people are saying, we should rewrite them. No, I say, don't rewrite them.
Yeah.
Write new stories for the children now. And they should be different because now children face different kind of dangers.
Yeah.
And so that's how you should go. But then that doesn't mean that you should completely discard the old stories. And this is the same with this book, is that this is an important book and it should go on the list. But I think it should come with all the things we just talked about.
None of the books on the list have, like, every single one of them. It's like, if it had to be a list of books where the politics holds to my politics and that I agree with, and the politics of the authors agree with my politics and stuff, the book would be books. The list of books would be, like, 3 books long. No, you have to include books which are interesting to, like, if the point of the SFBR Plus... reads is to be the best examples of science fiction available to read today. Which books are best for those wanting a deeper dive into science fiction? Which old books stand the test of time and which new books we will still be talking about or thinking about in decades to come? The books that stand the test of time isn't, do their politics still hold up?
Yeah.
It's more like, is this still a good book to read? Is this still a fun book to read? Is this still an interesting book to read?
Yes.
And that's where, for me, this book holds up.
Yes.
So,
I agree. I think the SFBRP is also very much a representative medium for critical thinking. And
what
I think
that is important. That we never talk about a book for less than 1 hour, 15 minutes.
No, but what I'm trying to say is that if you are reading anything or if you're consuming anything, it is so important to reflect on things and not just take them on face value and say, oh yeah, the hero always should just punch the bad guy.
Yeah.
Or should they? And why shouldn't they?
When it's been revealed to you that your entire life has got massive privilege and everything like that, the book should end with you like making life worse for someone who is less privileged than you. You're like, whatever. Anyway, all of this to say.
Okay.
Oh, I did make another note. The writing of this, I really like the folksy writing. Like, it's because it's set in the future of 1958, but like, it all of the references are to like technology, even though they're talking about like weird future stuff, like space technology and this kind of. There's something where it gets so cold it breaks to part, and it said, it was tool steel, but it went to pieces as if it had been cast out of type slugs. Do you know what type slugs are?
No.
Exactly. It's so good. Type slugs are, you know, when you do printing, you know, like movable type printing.
Yeah.
You have all these little bits of lead with letter, or not lead. You know, have these bits with these bits of metal.
Yeah, I know those.
And so you put them together into a word, and then you put a space there, and then like a dash or a, or like a or an like in this book, there's a dash in the title. Or something.
Yes.
So then you put the next ones down and you put a space and the next letters. And that those are type slugs.
Oh, right. So then I know where they are, yes.
They are bits of metal that go together, that you push together, and then you print words, and then you print a whole page, and then you print 1,000 pages with them, and then you disassemble the type, and then you typeset more. So it's type slugs. And that a bit of steel went to pieces as if it had been cast out of type slugs.
Oh, right.
Is an image that no child these days would ever think of, because it's literally 8 technologies out of date.
Yeah.
Like, the technology that kids are using to read a book these days is so far removed from type slugs that you have to, like, it's now historic to know what a type slug is, to be able to get a reference, which then was just a kid's reference that they were just expanded, like all kids in 1958 were expected to get. So
yes, and thing with the slider thing I have.
The slide rule, yeah.
Okay, well, I accepted that is how he did it.
Yeah,
maybe
now 5 technologies out of date.
Yes.
Because, like, it would have a slide rule, and that's how you can work it out. Then you'll have like a graphing calculator, and then you don't have a graphing calculator, you have like a computer.
Excel.
You have Excel. And then you've got a computer that you can type the code into, and then maybe now you'll have Google to search how to use those kind of things, and now you've got AI, which is sort of like, oh, how do
now
I work out this thing?
Now people just ask ChatGPT, and
ask ChatGPT, not just for the answer, but if you need to work out a novel answer, mm-hmm. you could say, like, to Claude Code, write me a program that works out this answer, and it spits out the answer for you. Or it works it out, writes the code, runs the code, and spits out the answer to it. So yes, a slide rule for technological, science and math solving problems is 5 technologies ago.
Yes.
But it's fun that it becomes like a plot point in this book. So I've looked there. Yes. So overall, I think this is a very fun book. Oh, yeah. Oh, one last thing that I wanted to mention.
Okay.
And I mentioned this on the previous episode that I did, not on the SFBRP, but as on the SFF Audio podcast when we were discussing it there.
Yeah.
Is that this book, the idea that there's no such thing as luck, there's only adequate or inadequate preparation to cope with the statistical universe, which is the father's way of like horrifically bringing up the child. And, you know, the hours of practice in the pasture was paying off, you know, and these other parts of the book, which reflects my personal philosophy of things, of sort mm-hmm. of like, oh, the more prepared I am and mm-hmm. the more things that I have. I mentioned this on the previous podcast, I did a whole episode number 100 of the SFBRP was, oh, actually, how would I even do this? Episode number, yeah, let's go here. Episode number was called Science Fiction and Personal Philosophy,
mm-hmm.
where I go through like the way that I live my life, or the way that I try and live my life, is to all the things that I'm doing, I'm preparing for the moment where I'm sent back in time, or I'm preparing for the moment where I'm abducted by aliens and need to tell people the history of the earth.
Yes.
Or I'm prepared for this. And of course, it's pure science fiction that I'm never going to be put into a situation where I will ever need to be in the position where I need to do a thing.
Yes.
That anything important. Like, I'm a professional juggler, it doesn't happen. But here's the thing. By always preparing for... Well, not always preparing. Always considering what I'm doing as preparation for a weird science fictional situation. When I'm in very mundane situations, suddenly I'm prepared to be there. And in this case, they go to the Magellanic Clouds and they're saying, oh, I've never seen the Magellanic Clouds because I've never been to the Southern Hemisphere. The first time, you know, the first time I ever went to the Southern Hemisphere was I went to Australia. Maybe I told this story in a podcast before. Went to Australia, went to Sydney Juggling Festival. And then went on a trip into the Blue Mountains, Katoomba.
Yeah.
And I was there and I was like, I want to see the Magellanic Clouds. So we went out, me and somebody else who I met in Katoomba who happened to be at the festival was there.
Yeah.
So we went out and I was like, right, I'm going to work out how to get to the Magellanic Cloud. And I'd been like, I'm prepared. I'd printed, this is before you having like an iPhone. So I printed out a star map of where to do. And I'm standing there, I'm looking around, I'm going, I can't quite see, I couldn't quite orientate my, you know, like where... And suddenly some people behind us on these ridges of these, like the Katoomba is like, there's this, it's like on the top of a mountain and you're looking out over a cliff.
Yeah.
And some people just behind us on the platform, behind us on the cliff, was sort of like, he's saying, hey, what are you looking for? And I was like, oh, Magellanic Clouds. And he's sort of like, oh, Here they are. And he got out of his pocket a laser pointer and pointed this super powerful laser pointer into the sky and pointed out the greater and lesser Magellanic Clouds.
Yeah.
And it turns out he is an astronomer who has works at an observatory nearby. And he was out there with some other people pointing them out. Like southern hemisphere, you know,
things that you would see that you can't
see when you're in the UK or whatever. And he'd pointing out there, and then we chatted, and it was, and I was like, oh, this is the thing. I was adequately prepared to be able to accidentally, statistically unlikely, but it is a statistical universe that I happen to be within earshot of a professional astronomer who had a laser pointer in his
because
pocket,
you
whose
went
job was pointing things out in the southern hemisphere.
Because you went to a point where the statistically likeliness that that would happen was certainly higher.
It's much higher that you're going to be able to see the Magellanic Clouds if you are in the southern hemisphere. If you don't stay in a city, that you go out to a place where it's got, you know,
you've
got elevation.
I
put together all of this. I could not be more prepared to be in the southern hemisphere to see the Magellanic Clouds for the first time than I was. And I was paid off by an almost unimaginably unlikely situation where somebody, I just happened to be standing within earshot of a professional astronomer whose job it was to point out things in the southern hemisphere.
Yes.
And this book, I can't believe that this book didn't make me think, I want to see the Magellanic Clouds. The first time I ever go to the southern hemisphere, I want to see the Magellanic Clouds.
Mm-hmm.
Because this book is, you know, that some of the characters are like, oh, I've never seen the Magellanic Clouds because I've never been to the southern hemisphere. And Pee-wee is like, well, I've seen that. I've been to the southern hemisphere. It's like, yeah, but whatever.
It's embarrassing. But I have more, two more points now again to say. And one is since I know you.
Yeah.
You would be the person I would want to be in any sort of catastrophe with. That's what I learned. You are really good for that.
In the weird science fiction situation where you need someone to...
In any sort of catastrophe.
Repair a...
You need to be with... I need to be with you.
Spacesuit.
And I feel the two characters in this book represent us quite well. And it's really weird because I just thought about, you know, when we recorded the podcast for the with the Dungeons and Dragons, and the person who pokes the weird tree with a stick, and then you have to get me out of it.
That's not you. That was your character.
It's kind of me. Okay. And so that is really, really fun.
Okay.
Because I'm more the social engineering person, and you do the practical engineering.
I also do social engineering. Don't worry
also,
about
oh, one more thing. Because we watch, like, you watch YouTube. You follow lots of YouTube channels. When I'm by myself, I don't generally do that. But when we do it, we watch often the channels of Brady Herrand, which are like the number file, 60 symbols, whatever.
Yeah, it's all astronomy and chemistry and mathematics.
Chemistry and science and whatever. And because we watch those, I had in this book much more knowledge than I would have had at any point in the past of my life, because I knew what M31 meant.
Right.
And I was very proud of that.
Yes. Yes, you were there. You already knew that it's Messier object,
something.
So that's cool. My point was, the entirety of episode 100 of the SFBRP, where I'm talking about science fiction and personal philosophy, which is my way of saying that I like to live my life as though I'm one chapter away from a big science fiction happening for me, and I'm the hero of the story.
Of course,
is that I struggle through that, and then you read this book, and I'm like, no, this is what I'm saying. Like, there's no such thing as luck. There is only adequate or inadequate preparation to cope with the statistical universe, and it's so minor in my life. Like, this is not a big part of my life.
No, it's an ongoing thing, though,
but it's an ongoing
there.
Part of my life, and I can think of like so many examples where I'm like, well, I'm so pleased that I read that book, or I'm so pleased that I did this. You know, I probably in that episode talked about getting into a fight in Barcelona when I was 16 years old, and I'd read a book about how to how most knockouts come by elbow strikes, and then I book learnt my way into winning a fight against a mugger in Barcelona, and all of these crazy stories, which you just think, well, how do you do that? How did that work? And so I'm like, well, you just gotta.
Read in a book.
Well, it's not once read in a book, but it's also practice. It's also preparation. Yes. It's also putting in so much time and effort into things to get to a point where I feel like I'd be proud to do something or proud to learn something or proud to show off something, you know, be that, you know, photography or music or writing or whatever like this. I always get the thing that I want to be up to, not to an expert level, but just to be a prepared level. For example, like someone says, oh, great. And now we need you to direct a movie. I'm like, oh, yeah, I'm ready to go. Oh, you, we want you to write a book. I was like, I've already written books. Oh, we want you to, you know, it, this is me in a, like an artistic point of view, but I think I'd be ready. I think I'd be prepared for so many things. And in the in my life where I have been tested in these ways or random things have come up, I have been the one who's been able to step forward. And that means that I need to not throw milkshakes in people's faces.
Yes.
You know, that's the most important part of all of this, is that I need to learn that, again, not great power comes with great responsibility, but the preparation also has to be in the way that I can't, like, I don't want to, I don't even know what I'm trying to say here.
No, but
like,
I, you there have... is
that empathy and kindness that has to come with, with thinking that, I'm not even saying that I am, like, more capable than other people, but thinking that I'm more capable than other people.
And I think you have made the conscious and unconscious steps to that learning curve. And I was a bit part of that because I have literally lived through you learning these kind of things.
Yeah.
And it's
but it's a lifelong thing. It's called growing up.
Of course it's a lifelong. And I really appreciate that because that is a skill and a mindset that is very important. And lots of people don't have that. Lots of people think of themselves as they need to develop in certain directions.
Yeah.
When what they should do is they should learn and reflect. And you do that. And I really appreciate that. And because I am then always the person that feels all the atmosphere, all the social things that are happening, where you are going for one thing and I understand what you're going for.
Yeah.
But the people around you have different
what I'm trying to say fields. Is I did an entire episode about this, talked for way too long, couldn't formulate my thoughts. But then my thoughts are the first six chapters, not the last chapters of this book, but the first few chapters of this book where it feels like someone is actually achieving stuff by like engineering themselves or engineering the situation and being prepared for stuff. And it's kind of annoying that at the end of the book, it's revealed that the person who says there's no such thing as luck, there's only adequate or inadequate preparation to cope with the statistical universe, is one of the monsters in the book. And it's the parents
the adults,
of the kids.
The adults.
And you're like, oh no.
The adults all mess it up.
Oh no. Either way, it's a bit of a pity. But like again, this book does reflect some of that. So we got to do two things.
Yes.
We got to give this book a rating. How much did you enjoy this book?
I really enjoy it. I think, I know it's weird to say this, it's I'm struggling between three and a half, four.
Yeah.
Because I don't think it's a 5-star book.
No, it's not a 5-star book.
It's not, it doesn't feel like a 4-star book because it's had too many.
Well, for me, it's a nostalgia read, so it's going to come out of 4 stars no matter what happens. Okay. Oh, look, put it this way. Like, I will now just engineer this rating that if you give it 3.5 stars, I'm going to give it 4.5 stars and it's going to end up at 4 stars.
Okay.
Is that all right?
That's okay.
Is it okay to leave it there?
It's not going to go to 3.75.
It's not going to go to 3.75. No, because I'm just going to engineer. Like, I make the rules.
You do the sweets counting.
My podcast, I make the rules.
You do the sweets counting, adult.
You revealed your rating before me, so I can just give the rating that I want to give to end up with the rating that I actually want to give.
Okay.
I'm very sorry.
Okay.
I'm very sorry. The game theory leads to me winning this one. Second question.
Yes.
Are we going to add it to the SFBRP must reads list?
I think we should.
Yeah?
Yeah.
You think so?
Yes.
Okay. Good. Well, then let's do it. I think, again, none of these books are perfect books, but I think they're all these books are all worth reading. It's a children's book from the golden age of science, or whatever it is we want to say.
And again, not a book from the 70s.
And not a book from the 70s. Yeah, we've got a few books here. Let's go see what its surroundings are here. 1958. So it comes after I Am Legend by Richard Matheson and 1 year before Starship Troopers by Robert Heinlein. So I think this is a kind of a good...
it's a good follow-up in the same...
It's a good table setting for a book. This was Heinlein's last children's book.
Yeah.
And after this, he's sort of I'm going to write just adult science fiction. And Starship Troopers was like a conscious turn. Sort of like, it feels like a young guy getting it ready, but this is you know, politics lectures and, you know, genocides and sex rather than Space Adventures with Funny Aliens.
Yes.
So there's that.
I have one more little thing to say.
Yeah, what's up?
And that was referring back to my comment at the beginning, how it, in German it's called Die Invasion der Wurmgesichter.
Yeah.
And they hardly they hardly play a role. We hardly talked about them.
Them becoming a slight threat is good enough. Entire annihilation. Let's just Holocaust them away and everyone's gone.
But what are the thought processes behind a person thinking, yeah, this is how this book should be called?
All right, let's...
They never read the book.
Let's wrap it up. We did a little bit longer than an hour and 15 minutes this time. But again, I wanted to get that me... Don't listen to the episode at 100. In fact, don't listen to any episode more than like 100 episodes ago, honestly. If it's not in the main feed from 100, like in the last 150 episodes, don't listen to it. I don't agree with anything that guy says. But in this case, I just wanted to reflect. I've not listened back to the episode, but I remember mentioning in the SFF audio podcast about it, saying, oh, I wish I'd have just read this book just before doing episode 100, because it would have been a lot shorter. It would have been like, yeah, this book. Right then.
What's coming up next?
What are you reading? I don't know. What is coming up next?
I'm still reading Ian and Banks' book.
I do want to do an episode of... Oh, yeah, because, like I say, there's some of these episodes which never had an SFBRP episode. Weirdly enough... War of the Worlds, never done a SFBRP episode about it. So I think we will do that.
Okay.
Maybe next month, whatever. It's a book that it can wait. It's fine. It's going to wait.
Okay.
But yeah, the only other book that I'm currently reading is the Eugene Tchaikovsky Tyrant Philosophers book number 3.
Yeah.
I thought I'd be further into it than I am now, but I've been reading other stuff like this book, catching up with this book and others. So I'll do that. And yeah, and I'm just going to reread some other books to see if they are going to stay on the SFBRP must-reads list. I haven't done an episode on all the books that I've reread for that. But I think episode 200 will wrap up that whole thing. And
what's the current episode number?
We are at 589. So in 11 episodes' time, we'll do the wrap-up of like the final...
Final current list.
We'll run through the current list. We'll talk about some books that are reread, which ones were added, which ones not, and if we learned anything. And you know, by rereading some good books and rereading some books which I thought were going to be good and turned out weren't that good. A few more to go, but let's give it a go. Let's have a look.
Okay, let's do it.
All right. That's it. You can become my friend. Oh, keep emailing me. We get emails.
It's really fun.
Someone emailed us saying, Brad emailed us saying, what books have you done for learning German? And that is zero books. I've never tried to read a novel in German.
I actually had a fun idea, which is actually would probably even fit with the SFBRP. But that's up for discussion.
Okay, maybe. Let's do this. After episode 200.
Yeah.
And we finish up the project, which...
200?
Episode 600, where we finish up the SFBRP must read list.
Yes.
Maybe the project can be Luke reads some German science fiction in German and we do some reviews of that. So
okay.
that might be a fun future project. What do you think?
Good idea. I will get my mum for some consultation.
Yeah, maybe. But it can't be stuff that's already translated or is easily translated into English. You know, I want to go back to the original. So whatever. Either way, let's have a look at that one. So I'll reply as an email to Brad as well. So keep sending emails to luke@juggler.net. Otherwise, become our friends on Goodreads. I'm not going to look through other people's reviews of this book, but whatever. So let's say 4 stars for this book. Gets added to the list. How Spacesuit Will Travel. Thanks a lot for listening and we'll catch you next time.
Goodbye.